To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class, the only radio show of its kind in Oregon or Southwest Washington. Our guest tonight was unable to make it, so as a substitute, we're going to hear a talk by Sharon Smith, the author of Women and Socialism, on intersectionality and Marxism.
People are here today simply to find out once and for all what the hell that seven-syllable word pronounced intersectionality actually means, because it actually seems to mean different things to different people based upon different interpretations of intersectionality, who are often, quite frankly, talking in gibberish to those not already schooled in the language of radical academic left. And therefore, this makes the whole situation even more confusing. So it might be easy to conclude, and I'm sure many people do, why bother with this silly debate? So, you know, I just want to give you a concrete image of, what intersectionality means, which is that it's like you're at a traffic intersection. That is, sometimes it goes like, you know, you've got the two streets, sometimes it's four streets or six streets, if it's a really big intersection. And the whole idea is that if you're standing in the middle of that intersection, you know, you've got cars coming at you from all different directions, but you're experiencing all of it at once. I'm gonna go into what that is, why it's central to the Black feminist tradition. Now, you know, I usually am not a fan of seven-syllable words, and in general, I tend to prefer if people do use shorter words, if it's at all possible, to convey their point so that people without a PhD can actually understand. Mm-hmm. But intersectionality, I think, is really worth us paying attention to. And I want to make two things absolutely clear. Number one, intersectionality is a concept. It's not a theory. That is, it's a description of how different forms of oppression, racism, sexism, you know, anti-LGBTQ, bigotry, and so on, interact with each other and become fused into a single experience. So that Black women, for example, are not just, they're not doubly oppressed in the sense of that they experience sexism in exactly the same way that white women or, you know, experience sexism, or that they experience racism exactly the way Black men do. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, it's so that's a really important aspect of intersectionality. Mm-hmm. And so secondly, having made that point that it's a concept, it's a description, not a theory, because it's a concept, it can actually be applied alongside different theories, that is, different explanations for the root of where these oppressions come from and different strategies for how to combat them. And now today, you know, it could be applied to separatism, for example. Mm-hmm. But really today, I think the two sort of competing ways that, the two sort of most likely alternatives are Marxism and postmodernism, or in particular, post-structuralism. Now, because Marxism and postmodernism are often antithetical, that is, they're, you know, kind of running at counter purposes, the concept of intersectionality can therefore be used in very different ways, and also in ways that are at cross purposes. So, and that's what I want to go through here. Marxism explains, as we know, all forms of oppression as rooted in class society, while theories stemming from postmodernism reject that idea as essentialist, and in particular reductionist, that is, reducing everything to the economic system. Now that's how we've come to the situation we have now, in which a number of Marxists have been dismissive or hostile to intersectionality as a whole without distinguishing these two competing theoretical foundations, black feminism and postmodernism, post-structuralism in particular. Now I'm going to try to clear this whole misunderstanding up in the time I have here. It's very important to acknowledge that the concept of intersectionality was not created by postmodernists, but is actually comes from a long tradition of black feminism that dates back to the time of slavery. So I think it's safe to say that the black feminist tradition really, deserves to be distinguished from something that came much, much more recently, and that is postmodernism. The black feminist tradition is based upon the recognition that because of racial segregation in U.S. society, that historically black women suffer in ways that are never experienced by white women, yet are so often ignored in movements of white middle-class feminists. For over a century, before the term intersectionality was coined in 1989 by black legal scholar and feminist Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, the same concept has existed since the time of Sojourner Truth. And it's been described in different ways that black women experience interlocking oppressions, overlapping oppressions, simultaneous oppressions, or similar, but the same kind of concept that intersectionality encompasses. It's also important to recognize that black feminism also contains a strong recognition of the class differences that exist between women, because the vast majority of the black population in the U.S. has always been part of first, slavery, and then the working class since then, and disproportionately living in poverty. So way back in 1851, when Sojourner Truth gave the now famous speech, "Ain't I a Woman?" Remember, she was delivering that to the women, to a group of white middle-class feminist suffragists at the Women's Convention in Akron, Ohio. She was telling them that her oppression as a former slave was nothing like that experienced by white middle-class women who are treated, certainly at that time, were treated as overly emotional, delicate flowers who always had to have, the smelling salts at their side, because, you just never know when they're gonna get overwhelmed. And they get helped in and out of carriages and carried over mud puddles. That's what Sojourner Truth says. But then she's trying to tell them that her oppression as a former slave is one of being brutalized and forced to labor in long hours for zero pay in horrible, brutalizing conditions. It's not a coincidence that Kimberly Crenshaw, in 1989, when she wrote that essay coining the term intersectionality, she pays homage to Sojourner Truth's speech in that essay. And this is what she said, quote, "When Sojourner Truth rose to speak, many white women urged that she be silenced, fearing that she would divert attention from women's suffrage to emancipation," that is the abolition of slavery. Here, Crenshaw is invoking a clear illustration of the degree of racism that black women have pretty much always faced within the white middle-class feminists. There's also a clear overlap historically, and I think this is very important to realize, between some black feminists and the Communist Party in the mid to late 20th century, including communist Claudia Jones back in the 1940s and early 50s, Angela Davis, who obviously was in the more recent era of modern women's liberation. And both of them also developed the concept of women's oppression as the intersecting, interlocking experiences of race, class, and gender. Now back in 1949, Claudia Jones wrote this essay that has been overlooked, to be honest, not just by feminists, but by most Marxists, in which she, the essay was called, I think, very persuasively, "An End to the Neglect of the Problems of the Negro Woman!" ! This is what she argued. Negro women as workers, as Negroes and as women, are the most oppressed strata of the whole population, end quote. In that same essay, Jones emphasizes sexual assault as a racial issue for Black women. She says, none so dramatizes the oppressed status of Negro womanhood as does the case of Rosalie Ingram, widowed mother of 14 children, two of them dead, who faces life imprisonment in a Georgia jail for the crime of defending herself from the indecent advances of a white supremacist. It exposes the hypocritical alibi of the lynchers of Negro manhood who have historically hidden behind the skirts of white women when they try to cover up their foul crimes with the chivalry of protecting white womanhood. So she ties those two things clearly together. Now that theme, that sexual assault is not simply a women's issue, but is also a racial issue in US society, was later pursued and expanded by Angela Davis. Of course, we know that she was then and continues to be a courageous fighter against all forms of exploitation and oppression, including the racist injustice system. Now, in her excellent book, Women, Race, and Class, in 1981, Angela Davis wrote, "But rape also has always had, also has had a toxic racial component in the United States since the time of slavery as a key weapon in maintaining the system of white supremacy," end quote. She goes on to say that rape is, quote, "an essential dimension of the social relations between slave master and slave." And then she describes rape as, quote, "a weapon of domination, a weapon of repression, whose covert goal was to extinguish slave women's will to resist and in the process to demoralize their men," end quote. So the institutionalized rape of Black women, as we know, long survived the system of slavery. And it took on its modern form, which, as Davis describes, group rape, perpetrated by the Ku Klux Klan and other terrorist organizations of the post-Civil War period, became an uncamouflaged political weapon in the drive to thwart the movement for Black equality. So what she's saying, of course, is that she's saying the caricature, you know, the flip side of the caricature of the virtuous white Southern belle who's, you know, constantly the prey of the male Black rapist, that the flip side of that for Black women, what Davis said, the fictional image of the Black man as rapist has always strengthened its inseparable companion, the image of the Black woman as chronically promiscuous. Viewed as loose women and whores, Black women's cries of rape would necessarily lack legitimacy. So Davis, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that Davis also went on and strongly criticized 1970s era white feminists for neglecting to integrate an analysis of racism with the theory and practice of combating rape. She said, during the contemporary anti-rape movement, few feminists seriously analyzed the special circumstances surrounding the Black woman as a rape victim. The historical knot binding Black women systematically abused and violated by white men to Black men, maimed and murdered because of the racist manipulation of the rape charge, has just begun to be acknowledged to any significant extent, end quote. Those are important words, I think, at least in the theme that I'm pursuing here. There are many other ways in which the experience of women's oppression is different between women of different races and classes. For example, as we know, reproductive rights. It's not just an issue of the right to and access to abortion for women of color who have historically and can continue to be, to suffer from sterilization abuse in this country and around the world. I think that's really important to acknowledge. Another way, the way in which working class women and women of color have always tended, and women, working class women of color in particular, have tended to hold paid jobs outside the home, while middle class and upper class women have tended to be trapped inside the home. Back in the 1960s, what this meant is that for black women, the U.S. government to issue an official report that blamed black women for black poverty due to the fact that they allegedly formed a quote-unquote black matriarchy because they worked outside the home and therefore, quote, emasculated their men.
This is KBOO Portland. You've been listening to a talk at Socialism 2016 on intersectionality and Marxism.
These are just a few examples among many in which black women's oppression is historically different than that experienced by middle-class white women. Now, throughout the 1960s and 70s, there was a strong movement among left-wing black, self-consciously left-wing black feminists. And this is best illustrated by the Combahee River Collective, a group of black lesbian feminists based in Boston in the 1970s until roughly around 1980. They identified themselves, in their own words, as Marxists. And in their kind of definitive statement that they issued in 1977, they said, "We are socialists because we believe that work must be organized for the collective benefit of those who do the work and create the products, and not for the profit of the bosses. Material resources must be equally distributed among those who create these resources. We are not convinced, however, that a socialist revolution that is not also a feminist and anti-racist revolution will guarantee our liberation. Although we are in essential agreement with Marxist theory, as it is applied to the very specific economic relationships he analyzed, we know that this analysis must be extended further in order for us to understand our specific economic situation as black women," end quote. Now that, I think, is a fairly reasonable point of view, and a point of view that I think today seems like common sense to most people on the left today. It's important to recognize that the Combahee River Collective did not stand for separatism, as some uninformed Marxists have accused them of. People have hopefully heard of Barbara Smith, black feminist scholar, one of the founding members of the Combahee River Collective. In 1984, she argued for a strategy of what she called coalition building, rather than quote unquote racial separatism. She said, her words, "Any kind of separatism is a dead end. There is no way that one oppressed group is going to topple a system by itself. Forming principled coalitions around specific issues is very important." So clearly not separatism. Now finally, I think it's important to recognize that the black feminist tradition has also always been tied to collective struggles against slavery, against segregation, against racism, against police brutality, against poverty, against the systematic rape of black women, and the systematic lynching of black men. I could go on, you understand the point I'm getting at. Connected struggle, collective struggle. But intersectionality, I want to finish by saying, discussing the black feminist portion of this talk, intersectionality, again, is a concept. But it's also a concept for understanding oppression, not exploitation. Even the commonly used term classism describes an aspect of class oppression, snobbery and elitism, but not actually the act of exploitation. Most black feminists acknowledge the systematic roots of racism and sexism, but tend to place far less emphasis than Marxists do on the connection between the system of exploitation and oppression. Now, Marxism is necessary because it provides a framework for understanding the relationship between oppression and exploitation. That is, oppression is a byproduct of the system of class exploitation, although I would argue a necessary byproduct of that. And also, Marxism identifies the agency for creating the material and social conditions that will make it possible to end both oppression and exploitation. And that agent is the working class. And that strategy is socialist revolution. And workers not only have the power to shut down the system when they go on strike, but also to replace it with a socialist society. It's not enough to strike down all the bad things that exist, you have to build something in its place. And although all group, many other groups in society suffer from oppression, only the working class has this unique power to shut down production and ultimately replace capitalism with a socialist society. So intersectionality needs Marxist theory, but it is also not only compatible with Marxist theory, but I would argue that Marxism can only benefit from integrating left-wing black feminism into our own politics and practice. Now, so far, what I tried to show... So far, what I've tried to show here is how the concept of intersectionality or interlocking oppressions was rooted in the black feminist tradition. Okay, so that's been established, and that this concept is also compatible with Marxism, and sometimes we've had overlapping membership between the Communist Party and other, you know, socialist movements and black feminists. So now I want to turn to postmodernism and contrast the postmodern interpretation of intersectionality with that basically transformed identity politics and launched a new meaning of identity politics. Laclau and Wolff explained their theory as a negation of socialist totality. So, it's pretty obvious that that's, you know. They say there are not, for example, necessary links between anti-sexism and anti-capitalism. They describe it as each struggle as free-floating without any necessarily relationship to any other struggle. And all of these are conducted entirely within what Marxists describe as the superstructure of society with no relationship to its economic base. Moreover, Laclau and Wolff, I think this is really significant for later on, like more recently, their concept of the autonomization of the spheres of struggle is not only that each struggle is limited to combating only one form, particular form of subordination within a particular social domain, but that it does not even need to involve more than one other person besides yourself to constitute struggle. They stated this explicitly. They said, many of these forms of resistance are made manifest not in the form of collective struggles, but through an increasingly armed individualism. So that, you can see where the emphasis is going here, and how it, you know, how as it gained traction on the broader left, that it shifted from emphasizing the potentials for solidarity between movements, but also a shift away from the collective struggle to the individual, interpersonal struggle. And this way, interpersonal relationships became the key sites of struggle, based on always subjective and partial and changing perceptions of which individual is in a position of dominance and which one is in a position of subordination at any given time. So like, he might be oppressing me this minute, and then 10 minutes later, I might be oppressing him. I mean, that's literally what we're talking about here. In this way, post-structuralists appropriated terms, and I think it's important to recognize this, if you want to talk about appropriation, appropriating terms such as identity politics and difference that originated in the 1970s era black feminism. But when the Comedy River Collective referred to the need for identity politics, for example, they were describing the group identity of black women. When they emphasized the importance of recognizing differences among women, they were referring to black women's collective invisibility within the white middle class feminist movement of the time in this country. But there's a world of difference between social identity, that is identifying as part of a social group, and individual identity. The post-structural conception of identity is based on that of individuals, while difference also can refer to any characteristic that sets an individual apart from others. whether it is related to oppression or not. You know, some people are simply prefer to be non-normative, and that's fine, but it's not the same as being collectively oppressed within the system. Now, it's worth noting that Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, when she was writing, she took issue in the 1990s, in the mid-1990s, with the version, what she called the version of anti-essentialism, embodying what might be called vulgarized social construction thesis, which is that since all categories are socially constructed, there is no such thing as, say, blacks or women. And thus it makes little sense to continue reproducing those categories by organizing around them. Mm-hmm. In contrast, she says, a beginning response to these questions requires that we first recognize that the organized identity groups in which we find ourselves are in fact coalitions, or at least potential coalitions waiting to be formed, end quote. And she finishes her argument by saying, at this point in history, a strong case can be made that the most critical resistance strategy for disempowered groups is to occupy and defend a politics of social location rather than to vacate and destroy it. I.e., black women need to organize as black women for black women's rights. There is such a thing, and it's important. Now, this is how the concept of intersectionality first developed within the black feminist tradition and much more recently emerged in the context of postmodernism. Now, language, it's confusing because some black feminists and some postmodernists use the same language, but again, they mean very different things by those same words, such as identity, politics, and intersectionality. So that's how it happened that we've got the term intersectionality that has such different meanings to different people. Now, more recent evolution of post-structuralist approach to identity politics and intersectionality, which we're much more familiar with today, has a strong influence on today's generation of activists, places an enormous emphasis on changing individual behavior and changing individual language as the most effective way to combat oppression. You know, and it's given rise to the idea of people calling each other out, you know, when they perceive that there's been an act of oppression or oppressive language being used, and so on. Today's generation doesn't realize the theoretical roots of postmodernism, because unless you're schooled in this, I mean, it's a lot of hard work learning this language, and most people don't, quite understandably. I really hope that Marxists do not lose sight of the value of the black feminist tradition, including intersectionality, and black feminism's contribution to combating the oppression of women of color, working class women, and the ways in which black feminism can advance Marxist theory and practice, just as Marxists already appear to appreciate the contributions of left-wing black nationalism, including Malcolm X, the Black Panther Party, and so on and so forth. And have attempted, I would argue Marxists have attempted, I think it's a fair statement, have attempted to incorporate aspects of that tradition into our own tradition, such as, you know, the right to armed self-defense, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The role of racial segregation in the United States has effectively prevented the development of a unified women's movement that fails to recognize the many implications of the historical racial divide. We have learned that the hard way. No movement can claim to speak for all women unless it speaks for women who also face the consequences of racism, and, you know, class inequality, exploitation, and so on and so forth, which of course women of color are always disproportionately represented in the working class. Race and class have to be central to the project of women's liberation if it is to be meaningful to those women who are the most oppressed by the system.
That wraps it up for this evening's Labor Radio Show this Monday and every Monday. You've been listening to Sharon Smith, author of Women and Socialism, talk about intersectionality. Stay tuned for Labor for Prison Pipeline, and tune in next week for Labor Radio.